Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. This week, you may think you know what it takes to make a great pizza, but you may well be wrong. We hear from Francesco Migoia, head of the Modernist Cuisine team, who have just released what is likely the most comprehensive book ever written about the world's favorite pie.
We did the research and there's like two countries in the world where you can't find pizza. But it's a food that is available and can be found in every corner of the planet.
We are also at Helsinki's Slush Conference, where food tech entrepreneurs revealed some of their new innovations.
In this first one, we have the dried larvae of the black soldier fly. So this is actually what we make our product from.
And of course, we'll hear a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. Three volumes and almost 1,700 pages, the award-winning Modernist Cuisine team in the US have been busy preparing their new release that is probably the most comprehensive book ever written about pizza. Modernist Pizza doesn't only cover the history, evolution and science of pizza, it also includes over 1,000 recipes and the instructions on how you get the best results, be it at home or in a professional kitchen. To find out more about the work the Modernist Cuisine team have done and the new tricks on pizza, I spoke to Francesco Migoia, who leads the Modernist Cuisine culinary team as head chef. Let's have a listen.
In 2017, we published another large book titled Modernist Bread. It was a 5-volume book, and it was going to be bigger. So we had to find ways of basically trimming content out to keep that book at 5 volumes. And so one of the things that made the most sense to us was to basically look at what would make the most sense to basically extract. And pizza made the most sense, mostly because, you know, we had a good amount of pages dedicated to it in that book, but also not enough. So it looked like it was something that we could segue as a project, you know, as we concluded our bread book, that would make sense because we're talking about fermented doughs. We're talking about, you know, flour, yeast, salt, water, et cetera. As different as bread is from pizza, it's also very similar. So that was the main reason, was it was a reason of practicality, of reducing content and creating a book for a food that is possibly the most popular food on the planet. I don't know exactly which countries there are, but we did the research and there's like two countries in the world where you can't find pizza. They're pretty remote countries. And, you know, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's a food that is available and can be found in every corner of the planet. So there was many reasons why it made sense to us.
Well, now the Modernist Cuisine team, you guys, you do have a reputation of digging deep and creating very extensive releases. For example, this book consists of 3 volumes and almost 1,700 pages. So you decided to write a book about pizza. How did you go on then conducting the research? What happened after that?
I think the first thing that we had to do was go to the source of its origin, which is in Naples, Italy. At least historically, that is what is recognized as the cradle of pizza. And so it consisted in going there, and we actually went 3 times in 2018, 3 separate times, not just to Naples. Our first trip was strictly Naples, but after that, we spread out to the north, south, east, and west of Naples to research pizza in the entire country. But it was part of the work that we did was also to identify what actual styles are styles that are worth elaborating on and which are, you know, what we would call pseudo styles, you know, not actual styles of pizza. That in itself was a bit of a task, mostly because if you ask a bunch of different people what different styles of pizza they know, some are sort of made up. Some are, you know, just changes in, you know, how you shape the dough and what you put on top of it. And a topping doesn't make a style, like Hawaiian pizza. It's not a style, it's a topping, right? For example. So that was the initial journey, consisted in trying to learn as many of these different styles as possible. So travel was an integral part of the whole process. And as I mentioned, Italy, but we also went to Brazil, we went to Argentina, we went to Japan, we went to France. And obviously in the United States, we went to every corner in which there was a distinct style, or at least a city where there was a really good representation of high quality pizzas, like Portland, Oregon. And so that was the part of the educational part, like learning as much as we possibly could. There was a lot of history that went into it. There's a lot of science that also goes into it. So we try to structure it. Not that we have a formula that we work on, but we do know what content needs to be in the book. So that is another starting point as well for us. It's just knowing that we're going to have to really talk to scientists, we're going to have to talk to historians, and we're going to have to talk to the people who make this product to learn as much as possible and basically translate that into a book that many people can read.
What kind of memories come to your mind first when you recall all that travel for this book? What kind of things did you come across? What surprised you?
There were a number of surprises, from the interesting surprises that just learning about how pizza came to be spread across the planet. And there's a thing that we say that it, you know, pizza basically was able to spread out throughout the world because of cholera. That is not an association that a lot of people particularly enjoy hearing, but it has to do with the fact that in the late 1800s, Naples was a city that, you know, had a cholera epidemic. And in order to resolve that, a lot of work had to be done in the sewage systems and the water systems. So people had to go so that they could clean up this whole mess. But if you think that they put people in temporary housing in those days, that is a mistaken thought. They were basically kicked out and said, you have to go and thank you very much. Goodbye. And so you have about 3 million people that between the 1860s and early 1900s left Naples, and they left to New York, or they went to Sao Paulo, and wherever they went, obviously they took the foods that they were accustomed to and they adapted them to those areas that they were in because, you know, ingredients are different and they vary and your ovens vary. And so that basically was able to establish pizza as a food that was available internationally due to all this immigration. But it was because of a disease that we have basically this access to this particular food. But also that as much as Italians are really embedded in the tradition of how Neapolitan pizza has to be made, if we look at pizza, how it was originally made and how it has basically evolved throughout time, it's not a very traditional food. In fact, the dough itself uses commercial yeast, which is a modern invention or development rather, where original pizzas were made with a sourdough starter. And so you'll rarely see any pizzaiolos in Naples utilizing anything but commercial yeast. And something that really surprised us was the openness with sharing information. We thought it was going to be a very insular community, very like guarded with their secrets. And they were very freely sharing a lot of this information. So that was a very pleasant surprise. And it was interesting to us that the better pizzaiolos, the better restaurants were more forthcoming with information than the ones that were not so good. It was almost like quite the opposite. The better the pizzeria, the more information received, the less well-regarded it was, or the lower quality, the secrets were more guarded. And that was a very interesting phenomenon to observe.
Did you come across any new and radical techniques, any individuals who were doing things differently?
Yes. In fact, in Naples, again, I'm going back to the fact that as much as they're rooted in tradition, there is also a lot of innovation occurring there. There's in the world of bread and now in panettone and in pizza, a lot of people seem to really covet these like really open crumb structures. When I say crumb structures, like when you make a cut through the pizza or the bread or the panettone, people like to see like these big open holes. And so that's not something you used to see in Neapolitan pizza, you know, 10 years ago. But today you have this younger generation of pizzaiolos that are really pushing the limits of how much water can go into dough and creating these very ethereal, very light pizzas that are very open crumbed with these very large crumb crusts that look like a cloud. So there is innovation happening there. There seems to be a group of people that are very like tied down to tradition, but this younger generation doesn't have this like centuries old pizzeria or like a family tradition of how they make pizzas. They really like to innovate and create new styles of a very familiar food. It looks slightly different. It tastes slightly different, but it's been well embraced and well accepted by the Italian community. And it's spread out. Again, that has influenced a lot of pizzaiolos across the planet to also look at, you know, creating these pizzas that look like, they call canotto, which means like a life raft, like a, you know, inflatable tube. That's where the name comes from. So if you try to picture that, that's, you know, more or less what these pizzas look like. And across the planet, we did see some innovation, nothing that was, you know, terribly groundbreaking, as, you know, if you would talk about molecular gastronomy and whatnot, but a lot of innovation also was in the process, not so much in the end result. And we saw some interesting aspects in that as far as, you know, what ingredients were used. There was a pizza maker that used seawater to make his dough, which was very interesting. It's not the best idea to just pull buckets of water out of the ocean to make dough, because sometimes, you know, there's stuff in that water that, like, you know, engine oil and whatnot that you wouldn't necessarily want to consume. But it seemed like an interesting concept because seawater is already salted and it has these other minerals to it that could make for a very flavorful pizza dough. And others that were using very interesting grains to make their flour and to make their doughs. You know, again, very flavorful, very multidimensional, as opposed to using just pure white flour.
It's interesting hearing all that, and I spotted some interesting numbers from your book, by the way. So you and your team visited as many as 250 pizzerias. You ate 800 pizzas on the road.
Yes.
And then after all the travels, you baked 12,000 pies in the Modernist Cuisine Labs. So after all that, what do you think about those rules you often come across when people talk about pizza, you know, about what kind of oven to use, what kind of water to use? Supposedly, you should be using Naples water. What are your thoughts about all that? Pineapples as well.
Well, I think that people often want to believe what they want to believe, and that's fine. But our job is to basically look at what those beliefs are and see if they hold any water, so to speak. So, for example, you mentioned, you know, some people think that you need to use water from Naples. And in fact, that was a story that was floated around in Naples for a while as a marketing ploy. But even the people of Naples eventually said that it was absurd, that it didn't make any sense, that the water from Naples doesn't make the pizzas any particularly special. But we tested it. We did similar tests in our bread book utilizing water for making bagels. And in the United States, people claim that the only good bagels are in New York City because of the water of New York City. Another myth that we debunked just by actually performing scientific tests on the dough and also sensory evaluations. So a lot of these rules, some are unspoken. There are some rules that are written actually by an association called the Associazione Verace Pizza Napolitana, which is the AVPN, which gives you basically a recognition or a certificate whether you're making pizza in the traditional way or not. And a very interesting thing that we saw with every place that we visited that had this like certificate was that they weren't really making it in that, you know, very strict format. They all had their like little variations, little twists that they did that diverged from this, you know, very traditional form of making pizza. But that is to say that there are many different ways of making very good pizza. And that's a very important thing to communicate. And that there are many different styles. And whether we like them or not is, you know, is a different story. You know, we talked about pineapple earlier, Hawaiian pizza. There's people who like that. So we do have a recipe for Hawaiian pizza. Is it the one I would order if I went to a pizzeria? It's probably not. It would probably be the last pizza I order because it is not my favorite. But part of our job is to be able to provide people with like, okay, so this is the best Hawaiian pizza you can have. This is the best way to prepare a pineapple, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, some of these rules, you know, what is the best oven and what is the best flour? It really is sort of a case by case scenario because there are so many different styles of pizza that there are better ways of making one style versus the other. But there's also ways of adapting with what you have to make good pizza because, frankly, you can make very good pizza at home if you had a couple of pieces of equipment that are going to help in that regard.
What would you recommend, by the way, equipment-wise?
Well, if you're making pizza at home, there are two things that I would recommend. The first is, I'm not sure if in England it's the same as in the United States, but in the United States, people like to utilize volume measures instead of weight measures. And that drives me crazy because it is completely inaccurate, especially for small ingredient quantities like salt and yeast. If you're trying to measure with a measuring spoon, it will always be a different quantity. So the first thing is to utilize a scale to weigh your ingredients. This way you're going to have accuracy and consistency. You don't even have to worry about it if you're measuring accurately. But the second thing is that, you know, let's face it, most home ovens are bad, even the very expensive ones, because they're meant for many different things. They're meant for roasting vegetables. They're meant for baking cakes. They're meant for all these things. And they don't do anything, one thing particularly well, because the way they work is by getting the air inside the oven hot. So what happens when you open the door? All that heat goes out. So it takes it a while to recover once you close the door. So a piece of equipment that I would recommend to sort of circumvent this is something that's called a baking steel. It is a slab of metal. It's about 3/8 of an inch thick, which is about 1.5 centimeters, more or less, maybe a little bit less. You know, some people have a baking stone, which is fine. It's better than nothing. But a baking steel is metal. It's solid metal. It's a very dense metal. And this sort of resolves a problem of how, you know, when you open your oven door, all that heat escapes. Well, the baking steel will have absorbed that heat and it retains that heat. So when I open the door, it doesn't matter tremendously. I put my pizza on top of it, close the door. That heat that is on that baking steel is going to radiate right into the pizza. It's going to make for a very crispy crust. It's going to bake it very quickly. It's going to give it a nice spring. It's going to brown it, not just at the bottom, but because it's radiating heat, it's going to help with browning on the top. And you're going to have a pizza that's going to look very much like a pizzeria pizza, not Neapolitan, right? If that's the one that you're going for, you're going to really need an oven that is specialized to that. It needs to be very hot. It needs to go to about 850, 900 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 440 degrees Celsius. So those are very specialized ovens. There are some home portable versions of this, like the Uni oven or the Gosney rock box. They're very good. They're for outdoor use, but they're very good. And they do produce these super ultra high temperatures for a Neapolitan pizza. But otherwise, for any other style, I would recommend just getting a baking steel. They're commercially available. They might be slightly costly, but the way I do it, I have one in my house. It just stays in the oven all the time because I use it for everything. I use it for, if I'm roasting vegetables, I'll put my sheet pan directly on top of the baking steel and it cooks them faster. If I'm roasting fish, chicken, whatever, it goes right on top of that. And it just stays in there. To me, it's the best way to just make sure that I'm always going to be cooking like I'm in a professional restaurant, but at home. It helps in many regards. Because if you think of commercial ovens or ovens of pizzerias, they're cooked on this oven floor. There's going to be a composite material, whether it be brick or stone or composite. These are materials that get very hot. They really hold that heat in and they really help create these like really crispy, beautiful pizzas. And so a baking steel really helps with that. That would be like probably my number one recommendation along with getting a scale.
Thank you for that great piece of advice. Now, I do acknowledge that my next question is probably something that people may disagree with and everyone has their own taste. But what do you think? Where does the best pizza come from? Is it Naples, Chicago, New York, or Sao Paulo?
They're just so different. I always am accused of being noncommittal with this answer, mostly because if I look at Neapolitan style pizza, it's a soft pizza. It's a pizza that should be eaten within 2 or 3 minutes of cooking it at 850 degrees Fahrenheit for 60 seconds. It's this fast consumption product where if we look at Detroit, for example, Detroit pizza or Roma, and these are thicker crusts. They're completely different. They're crispy. They're made ahead of time. They can sit for a long time. They are reheated. But if I had to pick a pizza that I like to eat, you know, on a very frequent basis, and that is something that I can easily make at home without having to plan too far ahead, would be what we call thin crust pizza, which there's different versions around the world that have different names. There's like Chicago thin crust. There's in Brazil, they have their own version, which is also a thin crust. But it's a dough that's very easy to make. It is very crispy. It's very thin, so it's not like very doughy. You can make it from start to finish in your home from about 3 to 4 hours. So it's very convenient in that regard. It also reheats very well. You can make it ahead of time. So I think as far as combination of convenience, flavor, taste, texture, my open-ended answer would be that a thin crust pizza is probably the one I would pick. But there's room for everything else too.
Francesca Migoia there, and the brand new cookbook Modernist Pizza is out now. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Maylie Evans.
Thanks, Marcus. The world's 50 best bars 2021 list has been revealed, featuring establishments from 17 countries. Connaught Bar in London bagged the top spot for the second consecutive year, winning both World's Best Bar and the Best Bar in Europe titles. And there's more reason to celebrate elsewhere in Europe, as Spain led the continent with 4 bars making the list. However, it is Singapore that has more representatives than any city in the world, with 6 bars on the list. From the best bars to one of the world's top restaurants, Geranium in Copenhagen, Denmark, has announced that in 2022 it will be going meat-free. The restaurant has 3 Michelin stars and was recently placed 2nd on a ranking of the world's 50 best restaurants. This new direction reflects the personal dietary choices of its chef Rasmus Kofod, who hasn't eaten meat for 5 years. While this might feel like a grand statement, Geranium currently serves meat only in small quantities and will retain fish on the new menu. Next up, British auction house Christie's has sold a single bottle of Perrier Jouet champagne for over £40,000. The bottle comes from the 1874 champagne vintage, and although it appeared dusty and unlabeled, the wine inside is said to have spent almost 150 years in ideal conditions. That is one expensive round. And finally, instead of wine, smoke-tainted grapes in California are being turned into vodka. Grapes destined to be made into Merlot and Malbec in Napa County were damaged by smoke after wildfires last year, making them unusable for wine. But a savvy partnership between Crimson Wine Group and Hangar One Vodka has given them a new lease of life as the popular spirit. All proceeds from the sales of the Smoky Tipple will go to the California Fire Foundation. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Maylee. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. Next, we head to Helsinki to hear from two Finnish companies that aim to revolutionize the food industry. Our correspondent in the capital, Petri Purtsov, visited Slush, Europe's main startup event, to hear about the latest innovations in the food and drink sector.
In little over a decade, Helsinki Slush has grown from a small student-led startup event into one of the largest of its kind in the world. The two-day event brought together thousands of innovators, startup entrepreneurs, and wealthy investors. Slush is a good place to take stock of the latest developments in various sectors, and the food and drink industry is no exception. Many of the companies at Slush had come up with innovative ways of improving the climate impact of the industry by solutions based on circular economy or new innovative ways of producing nutrients. One of the most talked about companies was Solar Foods, a local startup that has developed a technology that produces a single cell protein using just air and electricity. The company's founder, Pasi Vainikka, showed me the end result and explained its potential.
Okay, Pasi, so you've brought with you a small jar of sort of brown, orangey colored powder. What is it? And why is this what I'm holding in my hand right now? Why is it so revolutionary?
That is our product, single cell protein that we call Solein. It is made with a technology called gas fermentation. It's similar to making wine or beer, where typically you have a sugars liquid from grapes or fruits or similar, and you add yeast. And this yeast eats sugar for carbon and energy to grow, and expressing maybe alcohol to the surrounding liquid. But in this case, our microbe that we've found from nature, it does not eat sugar, but it eats hydrogen that we make from water with electricity, and carbon dioxide that we capture from the air. So instead of sugar, carbon dioxide and hydrogen. And that's where the very fundamental disconnection from agriculture happens in food production. And why this is significant and important is that almost all the environmental impacts of food production, whether it's pesticide, land use, use of fertilizers and so on, loss of habitat, they are due to the land use. And if we can disconnect food production from land use, then all the environmental impacts basically fall on your lap.
Using this technology, you could grow food in space as well, if I understood correctly.
That's right. So actually, we made a study and dimensioning initial study feasibility if we would launch our device for a Mars mission for a crew of six. And you need about a 40-liter fermenter for that crew. And recently, actually, we were recognized prize by NASA.
And finally, what's your future vision? Where will Solar Foods be in, let's say, 10 years' time?
We will be operating factories globally, providing ingredient, replacing animal nutrition, but also providing vitamins, not least vitamin A, that is very important for night vision, which is a big problem globally in nourishment-constrained areas. So factory scaling and kind of vanishing different kinds of food products, whether it's noodles, rice-based meals, breads, hummus, and different kinds of cultures and forms Solein can take.
According to Vainikka, the company's protein can be used in cooking in various ways.
In a way, we see Solein ingredient as an ingredient, so that it's like wheat flour. So you might buy that from supermarket. Everybody consumes it in practice, but you never eat it as such. But it's an ingredient that the powder form vanishes in different kinds of food products. But we don't propose anyone to eat this in a powder form, but rather we can make different kinds of dairy products using this ingredient. So it can be drink, it can be shake, or it can be yogurt-like, which is, by the way, my favorite, yogurt based on solein. The taste is very neutral, so you make the taste after. So that's dairy. Different kinds of meat alternative products, so whether it's kind of chicken-like structure, chunk, or burger patties, where you maybe make with a plant-based material the texture, the mouthfeeling, but you add the nourishment there by adding a protein ingredient. Typically, it's pea or soy protein today, so we can also be there.
Another promising Helsinki-based food startup is Volare. Their chief operating officer, Jarna Hyvönen, introduced me to some of their products and offered a taster too.
So basically, we help the food industry keep nutrients in the food chain. We upcycle side streams from the food industry back to the food chain. And also, we replace unsustainable proteins. And the way we do this is that we farm the black soldier fly on an industrial scale.
It looks like you've brought something with you, this transparent jar. What's inside?
Right, so in this first one, we have the dried larvae of the black soldier fly. So this is actually what we make our product from. It's the larvae stage of the fly before it metamorphoses to a fly. So this is the larvae. And then I have a couple of products here.
All right, can we open the jars and maybe take a look and smell a little bit?
Sure, you can also taste it if you really want to.
Oh my God, things I do for Morkel. All right, so I can taste this. What can I taste?
Yeah, so you can taste this product, but I recommend you smell it first. It's got quite a strong smell, which is actually important for our customers, because our customers are animals. So we actually sell this product to animal feed, so fish feed, for instance, and then the fish that you eat has eaten this product.
All right, let's have a smell. You know, it smells like animal food, maybe something that you would give to a fish. Am I correct? That's what it smells like?
Yes, it does. It's got quite a strong smell. We also have a purified version here, which would be suitable for human food. And that will be purified even further for this, and it would have a very mild taste and smell. But that's a thing of the future, so it's not something that we're doing now. But we have the capabilities already.
When you founded the company, what was the problem that you wanted to solve with the company?
Our founders, Ture and Matti, have been doing research since 2014 on the topic. And they both have a strong sort of environmental background and circular economy background. And the real problems that we're trying to solve are the big food waste issue of the world. So approximately 1/3 of all edible food goes to waste globally. And the other side of the problem is the protein demand. So the global protein demand is expected to almost double by 2050. And we are sort of connecting these two ends, creating protein from the food waste.
As we heard there, the food industry has a significant impact on the climate, both in terms of agriculture as well as food waste. But as Solar Foods, Volare and many other food sector innovators at Slush have shown, technology can help to make the industry more climate friendly. For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Burtsov.
Thanks, Petri. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our Menu spin-off show Food Neighbours for great recipes. This show was co-produced by Charlie Phil McCourt and Sophie Monahan-Coombs and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. This is Moth to the Flame by Swedish House Mafia and The Weeknd. Thanks for listening.